G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on Truth to You. That's truth2u.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter and keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, mate.
Good day, you too.
Chapter 16.
It's police, no? Oh, we're not dealing with the police today? Oh, okay.
You've had recent run-ins with the spiritual border patrol. I know the religious police, but we won't get into that because we'll never get off it. But oh my goodness!
Oh, yeah. It was just funny. I mean, the phone call itself was just funny. That's all.
Many people can relate, and believe me, I can as well. But we finally made it to chapter 16. This is David. This is David, right?
Oh, well, we finally reached the most dominant, most elaborate, most complex, most detailed character in the Bible.
That's a really good way to put it.
There is no other character in the Bible that's so detailed like King David. And we have to ask ourselves a question, why? And I think the answer is that because he is a symbol of what kingship should be, of the concept of the Messiah, of being the servant of God.
Mm-hmm.
And also he was the beginning of the kingship, so it's very important to record, you know, historically speaking, you know, who was the real beginning of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's quite common in the ancient world where, you know, the first of the line, the first of the characters, the grandfather of everything is the most detailed character, and his deeds are the most detailed. But also, I think that because King David and Saul overlap one another,
mm-hmm.
and the struggle between them, this is a very, very important issue in general for the kingship in Israel. And, you know, specifically in the First Temple period, after the breakoff of the two houses, they struggled who's the rightful king.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that struggle continued on years later, and I think that struggle still kind of continues until this very day, to a certain degree.
Mm.
And, you know, essentially, what's very important to point out here is King David is presented as a regular human being who makes mistakes, but is so loyal to God and so favored by God that no matter what, he's still favored.
Mm.
And the fact, I think one of the lessons taught here about his character is that the fact that one sins doesn't mean that one is abandoned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And absolutely. I think that's a very important point, because they were trying to talk about the house of David being a house of sinners, their hands are full of blood, you know, adultery and everything, and committing crimes. And God still turns around and says, no, I still want this person. Mm. I still want him. And that, first of all, I think completely spits in the face of replacement theology, number one. Amen. I think that's the number one thing that comes out of it, or one of the first things that comes out of it. Second of all, it's also a perspective on the issue of sin. I think that, you know, a lot of people who are very worried about sin. They're so concerned about sin. They're afraid. They're so afraid of sin that they jump from their own shadows.
Mm.
And I think that, yes, you know, Ashrei Adam Mefached Tamid, blessed is the man, or joyous is the man, or, you know, praise to the man who is always afraid. What does it mean? He's always afraid of sin. True, yeah, but it doesn't mean the person walks around quaking and quivering all the time. It's not what a person's supposed to do. Because the main point is that if you're loyal, you know, you can make mistakes.
I'm so glad you used that word. If you're loyal, it's not that God requires us to be perfect. He doesn't require us to be sinless. He requires us to be faithful, and he requires us to be loyal. And the faithfulness and loyalty of David to Yehovah is what really carried him through.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think one of the major places to go and look at the concept of, you know, being faithful and still making mistakes as a character of King David, I think it's also very important to read the first couple of chapters of Leviticus, where it presents if the prince sins, if the high priest sins. And now we're talking about the two most important characters in the biblical world, you know, like the high priest and the prince, which is basically the leader. And they can make mistakes. Now, their sacrifices are a bit more serious, but, you know, or if the nation sins and makes a mistake, the option of sin is there. The punishment of, for example, the exile, time of Jeremiah, was, if you look at it, the main argument are two things. There are two points in the argument against Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And they both are basically being disloyal to God and just complete moral corruption.
Mm.
It's not the issue of, oops, I stole something by mistake, or oops, I did steal, or oops, I did this or that.
I said a naughty word.
Oh, I said a naughty word, seriously. Yeah, I've heard that one. I've heard that one. And yeah, I don't, as I already pointed out in the past, I don't use cuss words or anything like that on a regular day basis, but I really don't see anywhere in the Bible where it says you're not allowed to use cuss words when they're appropriate. I mean, you know, a person walks around. I mean, I think that's actually a counter reaction, because, for example, they're in some societies, and I noticed it frequently when I was dealing with, I'm not here to offend anyone, but I was dealing a lot with Americans, and specifically Americans that come from, mainstream Americans, you know, guys who live in different cities, whatever it might be. We're not talking about religious ties, but people, tourists that come around. And the frequent use of cuss words was so abundant.
Abundant. I was going to say colorful, but abundant is good. Yeah.
Colorful. And what you have on television, for example, I remember I was watching Four Weddings and a Funeral when it came out years ago. And the first couple words is a play on a very, very specific four-lettered word.
Yes.
And I'm saying, I understand the humor, but there are easier words to use, and specifically because Hugh Grant is English,
yes.
there are some more subtle words you can use, which are not sure. as harsh. But I think
in that film, though, Yoel, I don't think they were going for subtlety in that scene.
Oh yeah, no, I agree. It wasn't going for subtlety. I mean, I think some of the jokes that were really, really, very in your face kind of jokes, which were very, very blunt. But I would say, I mean, I haven't seen the movie in years, but I vividly remember a lot of scenes from that movie. And I think the whole thing of not using cuss words, I mean, again, a moral person, you know, won't use cuss words. I mean, I don't drink alcohol for different reasons, including the issue of, you know, the if you look at the end of the book of Proverbs, it talks about, you know, not drinking alcohol. You know, don't drink too much wine and stuff like that. You know, does the Torah say you're not supposed to use drugs? No, the Torah never says something like that. But I think anyone with wits in their head know that you shouldn't, anyone who's smart enough knows that you shouldn't take drugs.
So you made mention of this last week. You said someone, you get people that write to you and they say, oh, such and such a sin. And you say to them, well, no, it's not necessarily a sin, but it's not necessarily good behavior. And and the difference between those two things is a sin is specific. If you go against something in the Torah, it says do not do such and such, you do that, well, it's a sin. But if it's not specific in the Torah, but culturally, as far as you understand, it's not good behavior, it's something to avoid, right? It's that simple.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Again, it's something that, we divide, with Jews, everything's very, very specific, very precise. So we divide things up into, what's a blunt sin, what is just don't do that, something that's culturally inappropriate, and something that you can do. End of story. You know, there's no question about it. And, you know, cussing, you know, for example, saying to someone that he's a dog, for example, and by the way, Book of Samuel uses that, but it uses to call someone kelev.
Yep.
You know, or you're saying that person, he's a low person that goes through garbage and he's like waste. The word kelev doesn't really mean anything when you just use it as a noun, but when you use it as an adjective, in the case of calling someone a dog, then you're using something something which is cursing someone, but it's not a cuss word. So can you turn around to say in someone, you know, he's a low life, he's a liar? I mean, even if you say to someone, he's a liar, or if you call someone by any kind of name, you're already going towards the issue of using bad language. So again, sometimes when people want to express their anger over something, some people would punch a wall, some people would punch a punching bag, some people go out for a walk, and some people use profanity. And you know what? I'm not gonna get overly excited. I don't like it when people use profanity next to me. But on the other hand, I can't criticize those people because I know how to cuss in several languages. And I use that sometimes because it happens that you bump your leg, because I don't wear shoes at home. I bump my leg by mistake, and I might throw out something in Russian or in German or in Arabic or in Hebrew or in whatever language that, you know, it's a really funny
first. That's a really good point. If you throw out a few colorful words in a different language, then is that culturally insensitive? Because the language of your particular culture, you're not using it, right? What's the problem?
Yeah, but you know, Arabic or Hebrew or Russian or English, you know, these are languages a lot of people here in Israel use, so most people know these okay. words. But no, I'll say something very, very simple. Some cultures, it's not a problem. Some cultures, it is a problem. And I think that really what's going on is that a lot of people are having a counter reaction to the fact that when you switch on your television, when you walk in the street and stuff like that, people use a lot of bad language. So it's mm-hmm. a counter reaction. It's not that it says so in the Bible. It's not that there's anywhere, Old Testament, New Testament, Talmud, writings of the church fathers, whatever. I mean, maybe the writings of church fathers you can find. But you probably can find, because it's a different mentality. But even in the sages, there's a passage in the Tractate of Megillah that talks about, I kind of flick in my head, it's page 18, but I don't know if it's really page 18, that says that you can tell an idol worshiper to take his idol and shove it up their rear end.
Yes, I remember.
And it's very blunt. Yeah. It's very, very blunt. And, you know, so that even rabbinic sages, and believe me, I've spent a lot of time with a lot of rabbis, and I remember when we studied this, I looked at a rabbi and said, what do you mean? He said to me, sometimes when you have to be blunt, you're blunt. Hmm. And you can say something which is offensive if it's necessary. You know, it really, really depends. You sometimes have to talk with certain people in a certain way to get the message through.
Sure.
And stuff like that. And this is what it is. You know, sometimes to get a point across the board, you have to be very, very blunt and very, very harsh. Okay. That's all really it is.
Not necessarily a sin. Moving on.
Yeah. And now we're going to see the opposite of being blunt and harsh. Now we're going to see someone avoiding certain things.
Yes, true. So here we go. Chapter 16. It says, it kicks off like this. And again, I've got a little heading. Yoel, I've got a little heading in my New King James Study Bible. It says, David anointed as king. And it says, now Yehovah said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel?
Now, again, your thing says rejected, and that's what it really means. But again, it's using, using the root ma'as. Ma'as is to, I forgot what the word means. Last week I was very good at translating it. Just a second. Let's open up a friendly Hebrew-English dictionary. Repulsive.
Oh, wow.
It's repulsive. You have, something which is repulsive. So here it's more verbal. So the person has spurned someone. You know, I have spurned him. I hate him to a repulsive level. I don't want to have any dealings with him.
Yeah. So he's saying to Samuel, why are you mourning over someone who I regard like this, right?
Yeah. I'm fed up of him. I'm done with him. That's it. I'm so fed up of him that I can't even think about his name. I'm just fed up. He's broken my word. I'm fed up. Let's
get on with it. And it begins with Yehovah saying to Samuel, can you get over it? Come on, let's move on.
I can think of a Monty Python thing. Get on with it.
Never mind. He says, fill your horn with oil and go. I am sending you to Yishai. How about I'm sending you to Yishai of Bethlehem, the Bethlehemites. Blah, 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 blah.
Beit HaLachmi.
Say again?
Beit HaLachmi.
Okay, I'm going to have to practice that one. For I have provided myself a king among his sons. Now, interestingly, Yoel, he doesn't say...
So what does Bethlehem mean, do you know?
House of bread.
So in Arabic, it means house of meat. Because in Arabic, lahm is lechem, or lahm, or something like that, is actually meat, which is interesting. Because the Arabic word for lechem, for bread, is khubz or something like that. Oh. And... it's very interesting that they have house of flesh, we have house of bread. Mm. And that's actually, by the way, has to do with culture, very quickly.
Sure.
Arabs are nomads. They're herdsmen. Their main food is what they get off the herd, which is meat. Mm-hmm. Their main protein was meat. Israelites are agricultural people. Their main food is grain.
Mm-hmm.
So for Israelites, the main food is bread. So, for example, and this is a very important thing to point out, the Arabs talk about them being from the land and blah, blah, blah. No, you're a bunch of nomads who came here with your goats. Mm. And which is historically true. They came as a conquering nation that was a bunch of herdsmen because they lived in the desert.
Mm.
And so for them, the main food on the table was meat. For Israelites, it was bread. Now, if you look throughout the Bible, they sat down to eat bread. So they brought over a bunch of rolls and sat down and ate bread. No, the main food, the main thing that everything was eaten with was bread of sorts. So they'll sit down and they'll have their you know, bird or whatever fowl they might have or meat or whatever it might be. But the main thing you see everywhere, everything they pick up, the meat they pick up, everything they pick up with bread. The bread is used as the spoon, fork, whatever, and as the main ingredient of the meal.
Mm. You've got me thinking about the pita bread in Israel. I can't find anything like that here in Australia.
So I can give you a recipe. But by the way, the pita bread, a lot of people think it's an Arab bread, and the Arabs don't have a word for pita. Arabs actually essentially don't have a P sound. So it used to be that they would say bita because they replaced the P with a B. Now it's a new thing because the Arabs, there's actually now in what's called the Palestinian dialect, they've added a new consonant to the Arab language, which is a P sound. And it looks like the B sound with, I think it's like three dots or something on top of it or something like that. And they had to invent this because a lot of Arabs are now speaking Hebrew, and it's actually become part of the Arab, the native to Israel, Palestinian dialect, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to
invent a new letter.
They had to invent a new letter, but pita is not Arab. It's not an Arab bread. It was, the Arabs were unaware of this bread until they came to this area.
So what does it mean? What does pita bread mean? What is it?
So first of all, pita is a word that shows up in Aramaic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is it a word that originated from Aramaic, or is it a word that originated from Greek? There is a Greek word that sounds like pita as well. I don't remember what the word is exactly. I'm not a Greek expert. I don't know anything about Greek.
but it does, no, seriously, no, you're right.
I tried to study.
It sounds like a Greek word. Now we should look that up. But it doesn't have a meaning in Hebrew.
Yeah, it has a meaning in Hebrew. It's like the word pat, pita is the very close words. It's actually in the Talmud. It talks about if a person says Baruch Achmanah Hay Pita, blessed is the merciful over this pita, this bread. Mm. That's considered to be like a type of benediction after the meal, It's a word that was well known to people who spoke Northern Semitic languages, but Arabic never had that word. It's a new word for Arabic, basically.
There you go. Beit Lechem. Okay. Yep. So Yehovah says, you know, I provided myself a king among his sons. Now, he doesn't say, go to Jesse and find his son David. He says, go to Jesse. He's got a bunch of sons.
David's name is not mentioned.
Not mentioned at all.
This entire piece he's just this person who shows up.
Yeah.
There's no name. He's not mentioned by name, and it's interesting. It's interesting that
Because obviously there's a point to be made, right? And we're gonna
he's a nobody.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting.
That's what I think. That's the point. Part of the point here is that he's a nobody.
Mm.
Saul, Samuel doesn't even know who he is.
Mm.
He's unknown. He's this child son. Don't know how old he is. Unknown. He's the one that deals with the herds. The being a herdsman actually is a real profession. It takes a lot of work, but it's a type of work that you give to a person that's really not really skilled in anything.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what it looks like. And again, I'm not undermining herdsmen. I have several friends who have herds and everything, and it is something that you need to know how to do.
Sure.
But the question is he a herdsman or is he a shepherd? And if you're a shepherd, all you're doing is you take the flock out, you make sure none of them get lost, and you bring it back. It was some kind of a profession that some people had, which was considered to be a low rank. If you're a herdsman, it means you own them.
Mm.
And that's one of the differences.
Sure.
So for example, if you go to the book of Amos, it says that Amos was from Tekoa, from the herdsmen, from the Nokdim. He was a person who was a herdsman. He raised herds.
Mm.
He was the shepherd. Mm. The shepherds were underneath the herdsmen. So here, his father's the herdsman, or his father is probably the owner of the flocks, and he's just the son that he's just given him some other job. You know, go take care of the herd.
Yeah,
and that might be part of. He's the youngest. He's doing a job that was considered to be something relatively low, as far as I know.
Mm.
And there's even a midrash that talks about it. That you know. that he was a herdsman. This was considered to be rank.
It's a humble position. Yeah, and so, exactly. Here he is. So he isn't even mentioned by name, but Yehovah is telling Samuel, go and anoint, you know, one of the sons. I'll tell you about it when you get there. But Samuel says, how can I go? If Shaul hears it, he will kill me. And Yehovah said, hey, take a heifer with you and say, I've come to sacrifice to Yehovah. Then invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I'll show you, you know, basically I'll show you what to do from there. So now I have a question here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this is a problem. Maybe you can help me out. But if I go to Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 13 and 14.
Okay, let me just go there. 12, 14 and 15, you said?
12 verses 13 and 14. I'll read them. Here we go. So it says, take heed to yourself that you do not offer your burnt offerings in every place that you see, but the place which Yehovah chooses in one of your tribes, these you shall offer your burnt offerings, and there you shall do all that I command.
What? Yeah, so basically you're asking the very simple question that suddenly the book of Deuteronomy tells us, oh, you can't sacrifice in anywhere you want. You have to sacrifice in one place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually a pretty elaborate question. This is not something you can answer in one leg. Okay, so there are different opinions. So first of all, if you take the harmonistic point of view of the Bible, which is the one I prefer to take, obviously I'm not a high criticism person. I don't believe in high criticism. I do say there are questions, but it doesn't mean that, you know, let's throw everything out. Moses didn't write the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very, very important to realize that, first of all, Shiloh is destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about when I bring you, when there's a place that I have chosen, then you bring all your sacrifices to there. So usually, traditionally, we explain that the reason that people are sacrificing outside of a temple had to do with the fact that there was actually no temple at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The ark was held somewhere with some of the implements, but there was no centralized place. So as long as there's a tabernacle somewhere, then unless it's an established tabernacle, we don't really have to abide to that. That's one possibility.
Mm-hmm.
There are problems with it. I'm not going to say it's 100%. Then you have the opinion that says that, oh, yeah, Book of Deuteronomy was written later on. There was no reason to sacrifice anywhere else. There was no reason they had to sacrifice in one place. It was something that was invented later on. That's a possibility. Again, we don't like that because we're saying that Moses wrote the whole Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the issue of the opinion, there's a very old account that the only meat you're allowed to eat is sacrificial meat, and therefore when you're far away from the temple, you just erect your own altar and you sacrifice an animal, and then the meat is, you're allowed to eat the meat.
True. But here we are we're talking about Beit Lechem, right? It's only next door.
We're not in Jerusalem yet.
Mm-hmm.
If the tabernacle's anywhere, it's in either in Gibeon or somewhere, somewhere. So the issue of sacrifices outside of the temple is a big part of high criticism. There are a lot of discussions about it because the issue of centralized the Josiah's reform and everything. It's a pretty complex subject. You can't really answer this on one leg.
Okay.
But the fact is that throughout the books we see that even major characters are sacrificing outside of the temple. Not talking about Elijah, because Elijah had a point to be made. Mm-hmm. So we're not using that example. But we do see throughout the book of Samuel, people are sacrificing outside. And you even have King Solomon that has already, there's an altar established in Jerusalem, and he still goes to the big raised area, the Bama, the high place of Givon, and he does things there as well. So it seems, I would say something very, very simple. It seems that the criticism over sacrificing outside of the temple was not as important as the issue of, you know, don't follow other gods. So as long as it was for God, maybe a certain level of blind eye was used here to avoid. Again, it's a complex subject. I can't really answer this on one leg because it is still something that is being researched, and there are no clear answers.
Sure. So there's another number of options there. So there's some homework for the listeners, but it's certainly a curious one. But however,
I do want to bring out one thing. Samuel's a prophet, and he was just commanded by God to take a heifer with him and sacrifice. So receiving a direct order like that would mean that we have an established, it goes like this, I have an established temple, but God told me to go somewhere else. Now, is that breaking Torah? It's a question. If someone, you will go to the thing about false prophets, what did it say? It tells you to go worship other gods. But if God's telling, if God is telling you to do something which is against Torah, but he told you to do it, then there's a side to say, okay, you have to do that. And the classic example that's used is the story when they were battling against the king of Moab, the three kings of Israel, this is the book, second book of Kings, I think it was, and they bring over Elisha, and he says to them, when you battle against them, you will destroy every tree and destroy every living altar. And destroying trees is forbidden. It says that if you're engaging in a,
because
in a
war against food.
A city, yeah. It, well, it depends how you translate. But you have a clear example. This is breaking Torah, and he's still, they're told to do this. So again, details like this are very problematic, and answering that will never be on one leg. You can write an entire essay about the subject.
Sure, okay. So there's some homework, as I say, for the listeners, but that's a really good example, Yoel. Thank you for that. So Samuel did what Yehovah said, and he went to Bethlehem, and the elders of the town were trembling at his coming and said, "What? Do you come peacefully?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm coming with peace."
Yeah, you just have to remember something very, very simple, that suddenly the elder of Israel, the elder, shows up at your doorstep. Either something's wrong, or because usually they announce, you tell them, I am about to come. You send a messenger saying, I'm about to arrive, and suddenly he shows up. Because he doesn't want to send a messenger, because probably Saul's following what's going on. He's waiting to hear from Samuel. He's waiting for news from Samuel, what's going to happen with him, and he's probably following him around or having some people watching over. And suddenly a messenger come over and say, oh, Samuel has gone to Bethlehem, and he wants to know why he's gone there. So he might suddenly show up. So he doesn't say anything. He doesn't send his messenger. Doesn't say anything. Just shows up. So that scares people. Suddenly such an important person shows up. I mean, for example, if Bibi Netanyahu suddenly knocks on my door, I would go like, why are you here? And I will be kind of concerned.
You would be kind of concerned. But he's, and not to mention, Yoel, of course, he did just sort of, take the head off Agag just a few verses ago. So,
exactly.
There might be some rumors just floating around,
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so he says, I'm here peaceably. I have come to sacrifice to Yehovah. Sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. And then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. And so it was, when they came, that he looked at Eliab. Now, is that God is God my father?
Eliab, my God is a father. Eliab.
There we go.
And by the way, very, very important thing, the word Av is the Hebrew word for father. The word Abba is an Aramaic word. Mm. Same thing with Ima. The Hebrew word for mother is Em. The Aramaic word is Ima. And a lot of people confuse us. They think that Abba is Hebrew. We use Abba in everyday life, but that's an influence of Aramaic.
So let me just ask you, so Ima is not the Hebrew?
Ima is not the Hebrew word for mother.
Well, I was confused about that. Now I'm clear. So what is the Hebrew word?
Em. And if you turn around to your mother, you say Imi, my mother.
Imi. That makes sense. Thank you, my friend.
Ki avivi mi azavuni.
So we,
for my mother and father have forsaken me. So that's how it's used in Hebrew.
Wow. And so he looks at this guy and he thinks, well, God is my father, that's his name. Surely Yehovah's anointed is before him. But Yehovah said to Samuel,
It just says Ach neged Adonai Mashiach. It says Ach. That's the word Ach here is used for emphasis. This is the Messiah of God.
There's a bit of pirate language going on there.
Ach, arg. No, that's actually Scottish. Ach.
Scottish.
No, I'm remembering I once met this lady from Glasgow and I could not understand a word she was saying.
No, I'm not kidding. I once sat down at a bar in Hungary in Budapest and I sat next to these two Scottish guys, nice guys. And they talked for a while, and I realized, I know you're speaking the same language, but I can't understand a word you're saying. So I just went, argh.
Yeah. Anyway. I don't know. You sit there, and you go like, what? Seriously, I met this lady from Glasgow, and she was trying to communicate with me, and then her husband in the end stepped in and translated what she was saying. It was funny. It was really, really funny.
So good day to everybody listening in Scotland.
Specifically in Glasgow.
Oh, well done.
It was nothing personal. It was just funny. I have relatives who are Welsh, and I sometimes don't, when they switch to their dialects, I have no idea what they're saying.
You know, I wouldn't mind getting around in a kilt every now and then.
Oh, I have an uncle who has a kilt. He actually wore one when his daughter got married because he's Irish.
Hey, there you go. So it was so Samuel thought this is the guy, but Yehovah said to Samuel, do not.
Oh, you know who should wear a kilt?
Who?
Jason.
Jason Spiritual Babies.
He lives in Ireland.
He's a little leprechaun. He should. Maybe he has one. I'll ask him next time.
He's English. No, he's English.
Yeah,
he's
but he lives in Ireland. No.
He lives in Ireland, but he's not from Ireland.
Yeah, I know, but he lives so close to the Guinness, you know, the Guinness factory. You can't live that close to the Guinness factory and you know, not be Irish. Okay. Surely he has a kilt. You've got a little Guinness cap too. I know that.
Oh yeah, I bought one when I was in England. I had to buy one. I had to buy one because it was like something very, very, very English, very Britain type of thing. Yeah. And I've never seen anyone here in Israel wear one of those. I've seen T-shirts. I've never seen a hat. So I bought one.
There you go. You're an individual. And so, speaking of which, but Yehovah said to Samuel, "Don't look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him."
Now, ma'astihu.
Ma'astihu. Oh, yeah. Oh, really?
Using
same word.
Again, the verb ma'as, there was something wrong with Eliav, something personal that only God could know. He says to him, don't look to his looks or his height. He's describing very, you know, Saul was considered to be very good looking and tall and everything. And he says to him, I don't like him. I despise him. Something wrong. And I think there's a bit of a hint of his character, is that when you go to the story with Goliath,
yeah, that's what I was about to say. Yeah,
his behavior towards David is nasty.
We get a little bit of insight into that, but we'll be doing that in the coming weeks.
He's a nasty person. He speaks down to his brother in a way that's nasty.
Yeah.
And that person cannot be a leader. If a person talks down to you, as a teacher, as a leader. That person should not be a leader.
Mm.
That person should not be a leader. The only situation that a leader can talk down to a person if that person is rude to you.
Mm-hmm.
If I, for example, are sitting in a lecture and someone's rude to me, then you can kind of talk down. You have to be respectful, obviously, but you can talk down to such a person because that person is just being disruptive and problematic and just there to cause trouble.
Mm.
Because if you disagree with someone, then there's a respectful way of doing it.
Sure.
And Eliav does something which is problematic in the eyes of God. That he talks down to his brother in a way that, I know you're hot. You've come here to see the guts and gore of the battle.
He belittles him. He belittles him is what he does. So we're gonna read about that next time. But here, the next part of the sentence, it says, this is what I've got in the English, Yoel. It says, because I have refused him, for Yehovah does not see as man sees. What do you have in the Hebrew? It goes on to say, for man looks at the outward appearance, but Yehovah looks at the heart.
So it says, actually, outward appearance. Okay, so the parallel here is eyes and heart. It says, it's for interesting syntax. Okay, it's an elliptical sentence where we're missing a piece here. So it says here, for not as man will see, who's the opposite here. So it's an elliptical sentence where it should be, and the Lord does not see as man sees. So there's probably your English corrected it. For man sees through the eyes, basically through the eyes, or what shows up in front of his eyes, and God sees the heart. God sees, you know, so man sees the outer appearance like Samuel did. He just suddenly saw this good-looking man, you know, probably big, strong guy, and, you know, look good-looking. And he says, oh, that's God's Messiah. And he's trying to teach him something. He's telling him, no, I look into the heart. I couldn't care what this guy looks like.
Now, we have to ask the question then, Yoel, because Shaul, he was head and shoulders above everybody else. He was a big, you know, big, good-looking guy. And yet his heart was not right before Yehovah.
Exactly. So there's a lesson being taught here that, you know, we tried with Saul. he looked a promising type of guy. And we also had the plus that he was good looking and tall, mm-hmm. you know, but we realized that's not really the main point, which is really the big thing. Our culture today pushes the thing of like, be like a rock star or be a model or something like that. And I think cultures always did that.
Mm.
But the Bible basically turns around and says, the issue of what a person looks is not the main point. Mm-hmm. It's what's inside. I once met a guy who was, you know, he had a limp and, you know, he spat when he was talking and everything. But this guy had such a pure heart.
Mm-hmm.
This guy will go out of his way to help people. This guy will go out of his way to do. And that's a person whose favor is in the eyes of God.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So it's like the opposite of what our culture pushes today. Even though even in Israel, people push the certain type of culture and everything. Mm-hmm. And you know, so it's just everything's very, very superficial.
Mm.
And this is the lesson that's brought here. And part of it also has to do with the way David's described.
Sure. So
David's described in a certain way.
And we're going to get there. But before we do, Abinadab, my father is noble?
Well, Nadiv can be a noble person. Usually Nadivim is usually the noble. So Avi is a noble. My father is noble. It can also be a claim on Avi Nadiv on the level of my father is, was the tip of my tongue. My father is generous.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so this is the next
basically,
one.
The abundance of God.
And he made him pass before Samuel, and he said, neither has Yehovah chosen this one. Then Jesse made Shema. What is Shema?
Some people say Shema is some kind of, a shortening of another name. I actually don't really remember exactly what the name Shema means.
Is it related to, as in Shema Yisrael? Is it?
No, it's written with a hey, not an ayin, so it's a different word.
Ah, a different word altogether. Okay. Anyhow, so there's another son, and he had
maybe it's an abbreviation of Shmaya. No, his name is Yah, maybe.
Mm-hmm,
an abbreviation of Shmaya or something like that.
Okay.
I don't know.
Shmaya. In any case, seven sons. Yeah, well, I mean, he had seven. I mean, eight including David, but he passed all his sons before
that's
Samuel.
I have friends who come from families of 18, 17, 16.
Wow, that's incredible.
I have one friend. He comes from a line of 17 children. He's like number 7 or 8 or something in the line. And when his oldest, I don't know if it was a brother and sister, had their first child, his mother was pregnant with one of the younger children.
Wow. How about that? Anyhow, so Yehovah said, I haven't chosen any of these. And Samuel said to Jesse, are these all the young men here? And he said, well, you know, there remains yet the youngest, and there he is, keeping the sheep. And this is what I've got. Yoel, tell me what you've got. But in verse 11, it says, and Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not sit down till he comes. Is that what you have?
Yeah. Lo nasov ad bo'ofo. We're not nasov. So hasava is the sitting down to eat. But hasava is also leaning on your side. If you've ever walked into a Bedouin tent or ever been in one of these things, they don't sit to eat. Because sitting, very strenuous on your back, very strenuous on your abs. And when you're sitting, you're pumping blood towards the muscle, not towards the digestive system. So they used to lean on their side, which means your legs can relax, your body can relax, your abs can relax, and your muscles are kind of like, oh,
fair enough.
They don't flex your muscles. And it's also, they had this understanding also that you only eat with your right hand. So they would lean on your, because, you know, you use your left hand for certain activities that are not very clean,
right?
Clean using the bathroom. And so they would use your right hand to eat with.
So you'd lean on your left elbow.
You'll lean on your left elbow, and there was this whole thing. They also believed something about that it's dangerous to lean on your right side because then you might swallow the wrong way. There's a whole bunch of things about it.
Hmm. Well, in any case, in verse 12, this is the first description that we have of David. And so he sent and he brought him in, and now this is what it says. Well, now he was ruddy with bright eyes and good looking.
So, okay, so what is it says here? Vehu admoni, from the word adom, red. Im yefe enayim, with, interesting that the adjective is before the noun, so it's yefe enayim, should be enayim yefot, yefe enayim. So it's more of a descriptive, it's more of a substantive meaning. He's mm-hmm. has good-looking eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Ve'tov ro'i, and he's good-looking. Now, what does Admoni mean? There are a lot of opinions what this word Admoni mean. The classic one, everyone says he was a redhead.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
We don't really know of redheads in that period. There is this claim that it's some kind of genetic defect. Nehemiah did not like hearing that because Nehemiah is kind of like a redhead-ish.
Maybe his complexion was reddish.
Exactly. So really when you look at it, is that when you look at the story of Esau, Esau's Admoni, kulo kaderet se'al, he's reddish and he's all covered with hair.
Mm.
But on the other hand, it doesn't say that he was red-headed. He said it was reddish. That probably has to do with his skin.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the reddish was to do with his hair, then the red would be referred to the hair, not to something else.
Mm.
So a lot of people say it has to do with his complexion. Now, some people say he was red skin. His skin was very red, he was brown with like a coppery reddish type mm-hmm. of color. My mm-hmm. grandmother, by the way, was like that. My grandmother was dark and she actually had reddish hair. She had mm-hmm. this burnt orange hair and very scruffy. She was like, she was living in England, and looked like nothing like the natives.
Sure.
You know, my grandparents were from the type of Jews who came from Eastern Europe who were very, very dark.
Mm-hmm.
And it was obvious they were Jewish. Now, my family got out of Europe before 1942 or even 1939. They got out of before everything happened. Mm. So they survived. But when, for example, one of the funny stories my dad tells is that my grandmother was taken out because we're living in London. My grandfather was left during the Second World War to help with putting up the bags of the sacks of of sand and helping out and everything, and all the girls were taken away up north to the villages, and she was so dark everyone thought she was just dirty.
Oh.
And this one lady tried to bathe her and clean her. Oh, poor child, she has nowhere to clean herself. And she turned around and says, no, I'm not dirty, this is my color, this is my skin complexion. So I can relate. So I can say, okay, maybe he was a bit like my grandmother, who was dark and reddish.
Mm.
But that's one possibility. There's even a midrash that says that he was red colored, because of the fact that there was a whole story with his father that the reason he was the lowest son is because they thought he was conceived in an inappropriate way. There's a whole midrash that you can look that one up that has to do with something with a servant, and a really strange story. Not very clear how you reach such a story, but something with one of the female servants, and his father fell in love with her and he wanted to be with her, and his mother didn't like the idea, so they switched and he was conceived, but his father said that he never slept with her and he was born. And so they say that his reddish complexion came from his father's overexcitement and heat towards this other woman. So it was expressed in the way a child was like. But that's a whole bunch of nonsense of what they believe in the ancient world. But in any case, some people say he was pinkish.
Right.
He was white and he was pinkish.
Well, this is what I look at my younger son William, and he's blonde. And he's got very light skin, but he has a reddish complexion. He's very sort of red cheeks, and his lips are very red. And but he's blue eye, blonde hair, but his skin and his lips and whatnot are just very, very red. And that's I often think of him as a reddish complexion. But good looking, it says, bright eyes and good looking. And if I look at good looking, it reminds me of the verse 7 where it says, "Do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, be confused him." But
yeah, but there's a difference. He's good looking. He's boyish. He doesn't look like a man.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of these guys, just for example, what are you going to do, pretty boy? Like sometimes you hear mm-hmm. you walk in the street and you see a guy, there's something going on and there's a fight starts, and you have this guy who's very boyish looking, maybe thin, doesn't look like a man.
Mm.
It's not a man. This is the whole thing with Saul. Saul was man.
Yes.
Old.
So it was big.
100% big, beefy guy.
Mm.
And so you got this little kid that shows up out of nowhere.
Right. And that's what it means there. Okay.
Yeah, probably. So he's the exact opposite. Whereas his brother's like a man with a beard and he's manly and her and everything. And so this kid shows up out of nowhere, which is, as we tend to say in Aramaic, Ibrat Mistabra, the exact opposite of what his older brother is. And then suddenly God says, arise, anoint him. That's the guy.
That's the guy.
And Samuel probably gave a funny look for something like, him? That?
Yeah, perhaps. But he took the horn of oil and he anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And now, it says, and the spirit of Jehovah came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel arose and went to Ramah.
Doesn't even say that they had the meal.
They had the meal. And this is what I was asking, because I know some translations in that verse that I asked you about in verse 11, some translations say, and Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not turn. We will not turn around until he comes here, as opposed to we will not sit down.
Yeah, so maybe this skips it. By the way, I just remembered something very important for the whole issue of it. That's the skin complexion. It says in the Song of Songs, was it 5:11 or something? It mentions about the dod, the loved one, the loved man, that he's reddish, but his hair is black.
Hmm.
So it probably it's a skin complexion and not has nothing to do with the hair.
I'm inclined to think so.
So am I. No, it's a Shir HaShirim, you know, in Song of Songs. It's very blunt. It says he says that he's Admoni. If you go to Song of Songs for a second, is it 5? What did I say? 5:11, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it says in 10, my beloved one is bright and red, Tagul Mereva, whatever that means, and Rosho Ketem Paz. His hair, the locks of his hair are as black as a raven.
Mm, yep.
So he's red and he has black hair.
Mm.
So he means he's good looking. It could be that in the ancient world, people who are pinkish were considered to be good looking.
Mm,
yeah. Maybe.
Okay, maybe. So there it is. And so now the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So off he goes. Now, what does it mean? What does it mean that the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward?
Probably means that he's guided by God now, directly mm-hmm. guided by God, which means he's slightly elevated psychologically. He has God on his side, so he's not afraid to do things. He's a bit more assertive. What he does succeeds. Mm-hmm. And we see this in the story. And by the way, it says, you know, the Spirit of the Lord, it was upon him, and the next verse does the exact opposite. The Spirit of the Lord removed from Saul.
Mm.
So Saul becomes demented. He's not as assertive. He's actually losing his mind.
Now, he's losing his mind pretty much. This is what I've got in verse 14. It says, but the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him. A distressing spirit?
Ruach ra'ah, an evil spirit.
Ra'ah. Evil.
It's not a demon or something. It's just a bad feeling all the time.
Mm.
You know, and so you can be as you are. You can have the Spirit of the Lord on you, and that, for example, we had with Samson, you know, Spirit of the Lord, and he went and he did amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can have the opposite of a bad spirit that comes upon someone, it drives a person mad.
So this is the options that we have. I mean, you mentioned a demon, but we don't really have demons in Tanakh. But what we do have is...
Yeah, well, the word shadim does show up, but it doesn't really mean demon. It means spirits or, mm-hmm. you know, maybe even a meaning of non-existing being. Spirits, a wind, you know, it's just something not real.
So in this case, we have a couple of options, right? One option is Judges 9:22, which says, after Abimelech had reigned over Israel 3 years... God sent a spirit of ill will between Abimelech and the men.
Yeah, now, exactly. It can be basically something that causes someone to behave in illogically and an erratic way that is just not good, unhealthy.
Now by the way, Yoel, now this is interesting. I'll just give the other option. The other option we find in 2 Kings 22 from 19 and on. I love this story. This story is great, but this is when Jehovah is saying, you know, who is going to persuade
Ahab? Persuade the prophets of Ahab to send to get him into the battle.
And a lying and a spirit came forward and said, I'll go and be a lying spirit in the mouths of all these prophets. And Yehovah said, good one. You will persuade him. Go and prevail and go and do so. So there's an actual lying spirit as opposed to the ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. But the interesting thing, Yoel, is that it's the same words, right? Here, ill will, also distressing and evil spirit. The word is rach. It's evil.
Ruach ra.
So there's a couple of options in as far as the quote unquote distressing spirit that I've got in my translation, but it is an evil spirit, and they're the two you can pick from. Is that fair?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think that's fair. It's just something that gets in between you and your mind, and your behavior becomes illogical.
Fair enough.
But yeah, you have to remember also in the ancient world they believe that you know. Any crazy behavior, something had to do with spirits that possess people. And if, for example, with here in the Mediterranean area, specifically in the Middle East, some people believe that being crazy is contagious because they believed it had to do with spirits. Mm. So the spirit can jump to you as well and drive you mad as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And Saul's servants, they said, hey, something's wrong with you, mate. Surely a distressing spirit from God is troubling you, an evil spirit from God. And they recognize that it's from God, right? Let our master now command your servant, who are before you, and seek out a man who is a skillful player on the harp, and it shall be that when he plays it with his hand, when the distressing, the evil spirit from God is upon you, that you shall be well.
So by the way, it uses the word kinor. And kinor, there's kinor and nevel. There's nevel asol and kinor. There's a whole bunch of these different names. Mm-hmm. And to tell you the truth, we're not too clear what these instruments were, what they looked like exactly. There are some drawings of string instruments from the period of the Bible, but it's not very clear what exactly this instrument was. It's very common to see people walking around with a harp or something like that, mm-hmm. And they'll say that's the harp of David, or this is the kinor David, mm-hmm. but probably not. It might have been like a 3 or 4 stringed instrument that you held in a certain way. It wasn't held up. It was like held outwards, and you play with two hands. It's not very clear what this instrument was.
Hmm. Okay, but in any case, it's supposed to remedy the evil spirit from God.
Yeah, you have. You also have. You know, music was considered to be something that will open up your mind to spirituality. It's Sufis use that until this very day. And meditation, people use music. Twinkly music supposed to somehow calm you down. Mm. And even in the Bible, it mentions that the prophet Elisha said, "Bring a musician to play to me, so the spirit of God will come upon him." And he'll be able to prophesize. Mm-hmm. So now I'm waiting for cults that go and play music so they can receive prophecy.
Right.
Also sects. Yes. Now, I'm waiting for this now. I'm just being funny. But you should know there are people that claim that when they sit and they listen to music and they open up their mind, they have some spiritual something spiritual happens to mm-hmm. them. And the real thing is that we're humans and we're combined of spirit and body, mm-hmm. and when we have music and we calm down, we're able to lose focus of the then the mind opens up. It's not something normal. It's our intellect. Mm-hmm. It's who we are as people. It's part of how we're built. We're spirit together with body. So it's reasonable. So you say, let's bring music. For example, when someone wants to be upbeat, someone wants to be happy, music usually does that.
Sure.
If you're working at home and you want to be able to be happy to do things, you put up some music that you like.
Yeah.
Or when you want to calm down, you put some kind of music that helps you fall asleep.
Yes.
It's normal. They did the same stuff that we do today.
And Shaul likes the idea, and he says, find a bloke like that. That'd be good. And so one of the servants... Now, here we have a problem, I think, with the chronology of the story.
How does David fit into this picture with the rest of the stories?
Because here is another... now, we've had one description of David. We've dealt with that. Here we are at verse 18. We have another description, and it seems to be provided after certain events. But it says, then one of the servants answered and said, look, I have seen the son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing, a mighty man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech, and handsome person, and Yehovah is with him. And
so that's the thing. It's bold. I personally say this again. This is an editor that sat down, a redactor sat down. Basically, it's not a redactor, an editor. And basically, what happened was, okay, we're talking about King David and becoming king, becoming anointed. Mm. Now he has the spirit. Now we have to go flip for a moment to what's going on with Saul. Mm. It's not that this happened. It doesn't necessarily mean it happened immediately, because they already know who David is. Yes. He's well known. Mm-hmm. And when we go to the story with Goliath, he says to his servants, yeah, "Who's his father? Who is this kid?" And he doesn't even know. He doesn't say who is this kid. He says, "Who's his father?"
Mm. There's
a lot of discussions. Like, maybe he did know who he was, and the only thing was that he was, who's this? If this kid shows up, maybe there's something about his family. I don't know. Maybe this family are real fierce people. So some people want to claim that, you know, there's a problem. I mean, we introduced him. He already met Saul, because we just had this description here, and now he's asking again. So they said there's a problem here. Maybe there are two storylines that got mixed together, and how Saul and David were introduced. But on the other hand, you know, David shows up, does a battle, becomes a warrior, but he's still nobody in the army of King Saul. He just knows he's the guy who defeated Goliath. Ooh, big whoop. And you know. Now the servant, this is the story that happened after the story with Goliath. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that the servant said, "Well, you know David, right? You know, the son of Jesse. Mm-hmm. You know, he actually is he's very good with music. I've seen him because he's in the camp." Yep. So he's sitting there in the camp and he's playing his music. So his servant says, "Oh, listen, we have someone that you've met already. You've seen him. You've seen that he's a warrior and everything. You know who this guy is. You can trust him." Because remember, this spirit calls him to become paranoid, mm-hmm, as well.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
He becomes deranged and paranoid. Mm-hmm. So he's suggesting someone that he knows he can trust, because this man did something big and courageous, yep, and et cetera. So this story is brought in here, but it's really over there. And it was brought in just to the issue of bringing the opposite. Yep. You know, David does this, and then there's a counter reaction to that.
Yeah, so I totally agree with that. I think you're absolutely right, where it says in verse 13 that the Spirit of the Lord came upon David, but the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. It's just playing one against the other like that, but there are a whole lot of events that took place between those verses, the opening verses of 16 and verse 14 and on. And mm-hmm, so it takes the opportunity to make a contrast, but there is and I think that solves the problem of chronology. So therefore Saul sent messages to Jesse and said, "Hey, send me David." And so Jesse loaded a donkey, we got some bread and some wine and a young goat, and sent them with David to Shaul, to Saul. And David came to Saul and stood before him, and he loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. Then Saul sent to Jesse, saying, "Please let David stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight."
It says please. I don't think a king says please. The word, so yeah, amod na. It says usually you have the word na, which is many times translated as please, but it's really saying, you know, let him do this, you know, bring him over. It's not necessarily the word please. It's an indication of request.
Mm. And so that actually concurs, by the way. I mean, we will get to the story of David and Goliath, but it does say that, let me see, Saul, it says somewhere that he didn't let him go home. He stayed. And I'm just looking for that verse, but it's eluding me right now. So we'll get back to that anyhow. But he did ask. He said, "Look, I want David to stay here." And so it was, whenever the spirit from God was upon Saul, that David would play the harp and play it with his hand. Then Saul would become refreshed and well, and the evil spirit would depart from him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, no comment.
That's basically. So we just had the introduction of David.
David. Now the story of stories, as far as David is concerned, this one really kicks it into gear, right?
Yeah, but there's one thing we didn't do. What does the name David mean?
Oh, that is a great question. David. So I think, does it mean beloved? Did I get that right?
I would say that it probably is related to the word Dod, and it has to do with the word of beloved, the beloved one.
Oh, excellent. There you go.
And by the way, there for many years, people were trying to say this wasn't his real name. This is some name that was given to him as the beloved one of God.
Mm-hmm.
And it was never his real name. But then they discovered that writing that says, "I have defeated," it was, I can't remember who did it. It was the Stella, it was discovered up north.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, I can't remember what it's called now. I defeated the king of the house of David. And I kind of slapped all the people in the face. Yeah. There is a, such a name, David, and
it's a Hebrew
it
name.
Was it's a real Hebrew name. It wasn't some name that was attached to some mythical, non-historical character of the ancient Israelite world.
Mm. Amen. So there we are. The introduction of David, chapter 16. Thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo. The Hebrew in Israel Facebook page is up and waiting for you to like it and go and join everybody else. I mean, how many are there? Like 1,100 people on there. No, there's more.
Oh, there's 1,400 and something I think we've reached.
1,400 odd people on there. Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page. Thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com?
Yeah, so whatever.
Anyway, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com is the email address should you want to get on the waiting list to have Hebrew lessons with Yoel. Again, Yoel, thank you for coming back on the program. And until next week, dear listeners, when we finally get into 1 Samuel chapter 17, David and Goliath is the story. I love it so much. I'm going to really enjoy that. Be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, God.